Have you recognized the pattern over the years? Every first Sunday of Lent begins with us following Jesus into the desert for 40 days of prayer, fasting, and battling temptation and Satan. Every Lent begins with that Sunday reading. And it cycles through the 3 years. So 1 year you hear it from Matthew, the next year Mark, and then Luke, and then it repeats. And every second Sunday of Lent, we hear of the Transfiguration. 1 year from each one of the Synoptic Gospels. After that, for the rest of Lent, the readings, they're different for each year until they converge back again at Holy Week. But every Lent, it begins with this pattern of out into the desert for 40 days with Jesus. And then right in the next Sunday, the Transfiguration. So as even as we're in the midst of the 40 days of this fast, to set our eyes and to set our hearts upon the final goal that God has promised to us, which is the goal that Peter, James, and John receive a small glimpse of in the Transfiguration, which is the glory of heaven. It's the glory of heaven and the Transfiguration that was promised to us of our mortal bodies in heaven as well, that they will become like Christ in glory. But that promise of the Transfiguration is one as well for our souls, that the Lord desires to do and work within our souls within these 40 days, that they become filled with the glory of the Lord as well.
This collection of readings for this particular Sunday of Lent, they're amazing.
They're incredible. First with Genesis. You know, the whole of Genesis begins with this wide scope. It's a universal scope. The entire universe God creates. And down into humanity, and there's the fall, and there's the flood over the entire earth, and the recreation of it. And so it starts, it's like this hourglass, with this wide scope of the whole world, the whole universe, and humanity. And it narrows down in the 12th chapter of Genesis, which we see today, to one man and his wife and this one family. And then from there, God begins to broaden it again, all toward a final goal. He begins to broaden it from this one man to this one family to this one nation, Israel, into the chosen new Israel, the church, and to the universal church and the salvation that God desires, and to the very end, the goal of Revelation and the union of all of God's creation with Him. But here in this 12th chapter of Genesis, we see Abram, who he's called to leave the safety of his home, to risk it all in faith for a promised land and descendants. And God is going to seal this promise in a covenant, which is different from a contract. It's not like they're writing this down and they each sign their name, or it's more than even them giving their word. It's being sealed in a covenant, which, think of marriage. What they're giving to one another is not just their word. They're giving their entire life. The husband, he vows his entire life to his bride. The bride, her entire life to her husband. And this is what God is proposing to Abram and his descendants. And in the Old Testament, a covenant was sealed in blood, because the only way it could end is in death. The only way marriage ends is in death, because it's a covenant. It's an exchange of persons who become one. And in the Old Testament, it's sealed in blood. And so you see these animals, they're split in half and their blood is spilled. And then what happens to seal the covenant is you walk between them, saying, essentially, that if I break this covenant, this is my fate. May it be done unto me as it's done unto this sacrifice. And so you could see Abram, after God had established and he set it up, with these animals split, a darkness descended upon him, and he's frozen in fear. Because he's entering a covenant with God. And if he breaks that covenant, or his people, that's their fate. But then God himself, in the smoke and in the torch of fire, passes through the sacrifice, and he himself seals the covenant, which is it's completely absurd. Because, I mean, how is God going to spill his blood? He's God. And how is God going to break the covenant? Well, spoiler alert, Abraham and his descendants, they shattered the covenant again and again and again. But this is what's sealed in this first reading. Paul, he's writing to the community, which is the very first place that the gospel of Jesus Christ was preached in all of the Western world, in Europe, in the city of Philippi, which the city of Philippi was this beautiful seaside retirement community for all the high-ranking Roman soldiers. These were the soldiers who were tough men, and they had risked it all at great sacrifice. Why? For this promised reward for them and for their families to be able to settle in this beautiful place, this reward of the city of Philippi. And so Paul is writing to these people, many of whom have converted to the faith. And you can imagine these are retired soldiers, and they're very patriotic people. They love the empire. And they love this place in which now, having survived all the battles, that they are able to enjoy the reward of. But he writes to them, and he says, our citizenship is in heaven. Our citizenship is in heaven. And so set your eyes and your hearts upon that reward. And he said, observe our model and pattern of conduct, and not that of those who make themselves the enemy of the cross of Christ. The enemy of the cross of Christ? Who are these people? I mean, you're an enemy of the cross? What, do they spit on the cross all the time? He tells us that the enemy of the cross of Christ is those who have set their eyes and their hearts upon earthly things. The people who have set their hearts not upon their eternal citizenship in heaven, but upon the comforts and the reward, the temporal reward that they were enjoying now. And he warns of the mortal danger of this. And so you have these first two readings in which they're meant, everyone, to create a problem in your mind. There's a tension here, because you have on one hand Paul, who's warning, do not set your sights and your heart upon some temporal reward, upon this little plot of land that you've been given for this short time. He's warning the Philippians in very strong language about that. Otherwise, your fate will be destruction. Meanwhile, Abram is being promised by God this promised land flowing with milk and honey, and a place for their many descendants, this promised land. And so you're supposed to hear the two, and there's a problem here, there's a tension, in which the gospel brings a great light to, because it's Jesus in the Transfiguration who fixes our eyes upon our eternal reward and upon the eternal promised land. So he takes three of his apostles, Peter, who is the one whom he will hand the keys to, John, whom he will entrust his mother to, and James, who will be the first of the apostles to spill his blood as the bishop of Jerusalem. And he takes them up upon Mount Tabor, and he's transfigured before them. And Pope Benedict, writing as Joseph Ratzinger, in his book, Jesus of Nazareth, he writes about this particular account in Luke. And he says that this is the only account of the Transfiguration where we heard why Jesus, what he was doing initially when he went up Mount Tabor. He went up there to pray. And Ratzinger says we have a glimpse in this gospel into what the prayer life of Jesus looked like. That almost all the time in the Gospels, we hear that Jesus went off by himself to pray. Jesus was alone praying by himself. Jesus awoke early in the morning to go off to pray. But here, he brings his apostles with him, and we see a glimpse into what his prayer life looks like, where his face is transformed and filled with light and this glory, and he hears the voice of God the Father, and he's speaking with these prophets. And so just to understand, this is what it looks like, his prayer life, so that when we come to Good Friday, when that's taken away from him, the darkness that descends upon Jesus himself, but he goes and he's speaking on this mountain with Moses, the one who gave the Israelites the law, and with the greatest of the prophets, Elijah. And what are they speaking about? They're speaking about Jesus' exodus that he is going to accomplish in Jerusalem. His exodus, which is his death upon the cross. His exodus, which is his new crossing through the Red Sea. The new Red Sea, which is now the sea of his precious blood, which is being spilt to establish now, to transfigure now the covenant. The new and everlasting covenant. And what is that which is still with us? It's the Eucharist. It's his body that's broken and his blood that is poured out. It's the covenant and God's part of it in which he gives us in that his entire life and everything within that. And what does he ask us in return for our part of the covenant? Nothing much. Just your whole life. Just to risk all of it. And even be willing to pour out your blood in small ways and in great. He establishes the new covenant. And he accomplishes his exodus into the true and eternal promised land of heaven, which is where our citizenship belongs and which is promised to those who die with Jesus Christ. And this is the pattern that the readings in Lent are going to converge back again on in Holy Week, beginning with Passion Sunday, Palm Sunday, and in the Triduum, Holy Thursday, the celebration of the new covenant, an eternal covenant that's established, Good Friday, in which Jesus seals that covenant in his body, which is broken, and his blood, which is spilled out. In the Easter Vigil, in which we cross over in that exodus as well, again through the waters of baptism, and into the resurrected life of Christ, in which our bodies and our souls will become like His, filled with this glory, filled with all the light of heaven, and to set our eyes and our hearts upon that promised land.